just want to make sure that everything is...
Sure.
Oh, I know what I don't.
Be sent. Just make sure. I think that's working all right.
Yes.
Okay.
I think that's fine.
Let me begin then by indicating that today is December 13th, 1994, and this is Jim Boning speaking with Richard Heckert in his office at the DuPont building in Wilmington. Dr. Heckert, I know you were born in Oxford, Ohio on January 13th, 1924, and your father was a professor at Miami University. Could you tell me a little more about your father and mother and some of your family background?
Well, Dad was an immigrant. He came. He was born in 1872, came to the U.S. in 1886 when he was 14, and came alone, which always sort of amazed me. He had an uncle over here that was supposed to help him get started and, I guess, look after him until he was old enough to take care of himself. Somehow that relationship didn't work out very well, so Dad and his uncle parted company. And my father went to Minneapolis, or Minnesota rather, where they spoke a lot of German in those days. Got a job as a farmhand on a German family's farm, and worked there for a number of years, married the farmer's daughter, my mother. For whatever reason, Dad had a consuming interest in education, and he finished high school in the U.S., went to college, finished his four-year degree in college, and then went to graduate school in Columbia and got a Ph.D. in education from Columbia, which always impressed me and somewhat amazed me that this immigrant kid would have that much interest in education and that much drive to get it. So he was a very interesting person in his own right. He liked science. I rummaged through our attic one time and found some biology slides that he'd prepared for a course in biology, apparently. He never talked much about that interest, but he clearly had it and maintained it all his life. So, mother was a farmer's daughter, and Dad met her at an early age, and their marriage was a very constructive and wonderful thing. They celebrated their 50th anniversary with, I guess, a 1952, or maybe a little before then, can't recall exactly, and Dad died a year or two later. But that's a thumbnail sketch. He taught in couple of places, but wound up at Miami and spent most of his time as director of the teacher training school, McGuffey, and a professor of philosophy of education at Miami.
You are the youngest of four,
yes.
I recall, and the other three, it seems, are quite a bit older than
quite you. Quite a bit. I was a surprise, and whether it was a good one or not remains to be determined, I guess.
We'll come back to your older brother in a moment, but what was it like growing up in Oxford at that time?
Well, Oxford was a small town, and Miami at that time was a relatively small university, perhaps 3,000 students when I attended, and somewhat less as I grew up. It had all the advantages of a small town. If you got into mischief, by the time you got home for lunch, your mother knew about it. So retribution was quick, and it was a wonderful place to grow up. Oxford's a very lovely little town, and was then, and still is, a nice location. The university environment was certainly conducive to learning, and just a wonderful place to spend your youth. I feel very fortunate to have been raised in that setting compared to some that kids suffer today.
I understand you played football for Weave U back in high school, which was
that's true. Weave was our high school coach for the years that I was in school there, and a wonderful man, obviously a good coach. His later career demonstrated, but more than that, he was a friend of every kid that he worked with, and he made a lot of them better than they were when he got them. He just had a way of straightening kids out that were on the wrong path. So he was a developer of good young people as well as a pretty good coach. Still alive, incidentally, and still lives in Oxford.
Really? I didn't realize that. Were there any other extracurricular activities? Sports? Was the sports an interest?
Well, I've played everything and liked everything. I loved to hunt and fish, still do. My dad, being a college professor, did have time in the summer, and he took us camping year after year for a month or so. And we lived in a tent in the woods. A great way to experience the joys of nature. He never hunted much, but he didn't have any objection to my hunting. And so I had a shotgun early in my life, and I've used it ever since.
What kind of interests, academic interests, were you developing in high school?
I suppose because of my brother's love of science and math, I sort of got steered in that direction. But I really liked the physical sciences and math early in life, and felt challenged by them and enjoyed them. So thanks to some very good teachers at the grade school and high school level, it was easy to genuinely enjoy those subjects and to want a career in them.
Did you interact much with your brother? He was, what, almost 20 years older than you?
No, all my siblings were out of the nest before I have any recollection of them. My sister and brother lived nearby. My younger brother lived nearby for a few years, so I saw them fairly often. But Wendy, we call him Winfield, lived here on the East Coast, and we saw him a couple of weeks a year on vacation. That was it. So I didn't have any extensive contact with him, but when we were together, he was always pushing a career in chemistry, and I thank him for that.
And he was at DuPont.
He was at DuPont. He came, I think, to this company in 1928, survived the Depression, did very well personally, and thoroughly enjoyed his work.
Was it preordained you would go to Miami University?
It was cheap and it was convenient. I think my college education probably cost my dad $400 or $500, and that was just the right price for those days. But it was also a good school. I had no regrets about that.
What was the, let's see, you started there probably, what, 1940?
41.
41.
Fall of 41.
Just before Pearl Harbor.
Right.
Did that have any influence on your college?
Yes, it kind of a sad experience to go through school in that environment. I was lucky enough to get deferred until I finished, which was certainly a good fortune. But the male population dwindled very rapidly, and in the last couple of years, I did it in 3 years, because of the urgency to get out if I could with a degree. And the last year and a half wasn't nearly as normal and as much fun as it would have been otherwise, but I got it done, and that was very helpful. I actually graduated when I had been in the Army for a few weeks.
What were some of your experiences there in terms of the chemistry? What kind of courses were they offering? What was the faculty like?
Faculty was very good, both in math, physics, and chemistry, all three. I was blessed with excellent teachers, excellent professors. In chemistry, can't remember the names of all of them. The inorganic courses were the first ones, and then organic chemistry, and Carl Webb I remember very well. He was a kind of a dour old gentleman. He loved chemistry, and I think he enjoyed the fact that it was a little difficult, And both he and his subject matter were occasionally intimidating, but he was a very warm person underneath, and he and I became very, very good friends. Analytical, I took, and physical chemistry, so those were just the four principal courses, and some others that were related. All well taught, and all thoroughly enjoyable, at least I thought so. Math, there was a friend of mine, say a father of a friend of mine, close friend, that was an excellent math teacher, and I had a course from him which was absolutely marvelous, calculus. And the other teachers I had were also fine, stimulating, and friendly and helpful. Physics, my next door neighbor taught physics. So in that environment, you know, you really do know the faculty pretty well if you're a faculty kid. And there is no excuse for not doing your best. So, for the most part, it went well.
Many were there. Well, we just said the war, so there weren't, the male population was dwindling. But were there many chem majors?
By the time I graduated, there were a half a dozen left. Many of them came back and finished later on, but their ranks were decimated.
How did you manage to get deferments?
I have no idea, but I'm grateful. I had obviously a good grade average, and for whatever reason, because I guess I was taking the right courses, and I got two or three in a row, which gave me just enough time to finish my work, and then I was drafted and spent a little time in the infantry, but most of it at Oak Ridge, which was a great experience.
I was going to ask you how, well, when you were drafted, where did you go first?
Texas, Camp Fannin.
Okay.
Infantry Replacement Training Corps, which means that from the time you're inducted to the time you're in the trench, it's about 13 weeks. But at the 10th week, I was very lucky. Oak Ridge ran out of chemists, and they came looking. Half a dozen of us came from Camp Fannin to Oak Ridge. And interestingly, three of those later wound up with DuPont.
Hmm.
Dave Barnes and Larkin Wires and myself.
And what were you asked to do at Oak Ridge?
Well, I started out in a sort of a tech service group. Plant, the methods group, I guess you'd call it, trying to improve the process by studying the practices, methods used, and make suggested changes to make things better. I didn't like that work very much. I was much more of an activist than that. And later on, not too many weeks after I got there, one of the process sections needed an additional member in supervision. I was brought there initially in a technical capacity, and then actually in line management of that function. That was a very important turning point in my life. I really liked that work. I liked the hands-on process aspect of it. Of course, it was new and exciting, and changes were coming very fast because that work had never been piloted. The plant was the pilot plant, and so we were learning as we did our work. And it was just a marvelous experience and convinced me that maybe I should not become a teacher, maybe I ought to really get into business and work in something other than just research. So that's where the slight derailment in career thoughts occurred. I probably would have been a teacher had it not been for that. At least I was headed in that direction, professor. I would have gone on to graduate school, I'm sure of that, but I probably would have looked at the academic work very favorably.
Who were you working for, and in what specific group were you working?
I was working with the Y-12 division, in what we called salvage, which was an operation designed to recover as much of the enriched material as they could. And in that process, there were two enrichments. The first, from ordinary uranium deposits to an enriched U-235 material. That had to be recycled one more time to make it weapons-grade material. Well, after the first treatment, you had a fortune invested in every ounce, not very much of it to work with, and so salvage was very important to make sure that none of it was lost that could possibly be recovered. So we did everything from clean old pieces of equipment to burn clothing and extract uranium from the residues. We tried to get everything that got out of the system back into the system that we possibly could. So we had a variety of chemical unit operations, all kinds of countercurrent extraction materials, centrifuges and filters and all the digestion tanks and all the rest that a normal chemical plant has. And it was just fun. It was the only course in chemical engineering I ever had, but it was good. and the price was right. So that's what I did. As I say, initially I was kind of a technical assistance person, but I got into line management and ran a unit of that particular division for a few months.
Were you, how were you briefed about what the purpose of all of this was?
Well, none of us knew exactly how it was going to be used, but we knew we were working with uranium. We knew we were working with U-235 specifically. The only two logical things that could be done with that material was, number one, to make a bomb out of it. That was everybody's bet. But it was not out of the question that the radioactivity could be a basis for some kind of weapon. And so that couldn't be totally ruled out, but those of us that thought about it, I think most of us assumed it would be an explosive. We were never told that. We were only told what we were doing, what the goal of the plant was, which was to recover U-235 from the mix with 238.
What were the safety considerations like?
I don't think we were nearly as concerned about radiation as people are today. We worked very hard to be sure we didn't exceed the critical mass. You know, we didn't want too much material stored in one place. So that safety aspect was given a great deal of attention. I never worked with the material that was processed twice, that is the purest 235 that we made. I don't know exactly what precautions were taken with that, but I'm sure critical mass was one thing it was paid a great deal of attention to. But the other handling procedures I'm not familiar with. We dealt with the salt and the fluoride and the oxide of uranium, and had the normal chemical process safety concerns and the normal safety problems. But it was pretty much, don't get it on you. Don't put too much in one corner. And be careful when things are under pressure or hot, you know, that sort of thing. But I have to say, we were not anywhere near as concerned about radiation per se as people are today, and most of us have not suffered from it, but I suppose history's still working on that.
When the bomb was dropped in 45, what effect did that have? What was your reaction to that?
Well, my reaction was very positive, and it's never changed. There are detractors from the program, and I'm constantly told by people who were yet unborn that it wasn't necessary, but having lived through that period, I think it saved a very, very large number of lives on both sides. And I think a good deal of the world stability that existed in the next 50 years was due to the threat of this terrible material. So I don't think there is such a thing as a humane war. I think that's a non sequitur if there ever was one. Oxymoron or whatever, however you want to categorize it. And so, it's a terrible weapon, but it did bring an end to that war much more quickly than would otherwise have happened. And the subsequent peaceful uses of atomic energy really are very good. Some countries have done it better than we in the U.S. France has done superbly with generating power from uranium. We got all bogged down and distracted by some things that really weren't all that important, and we deprived ourselves of a source of energy that is really very, very benign environmentally. It's really a very nice, clean stuff if you do it right. And we still fuss about not being able to treat used material satisfactorily or store it satisfactorily when the French have been doing it for, 30 or 40 years and very efficiently. And we just have no excuse for the way that we've managed our affairs nationally. Too bad. But no regrets. At the time, all of us who worked on the project felt very good that we hadn't just dodged the less attractive aspects of the war, but we had in fact made a contribution to bring the whole darn thing to a close.
Now, you were still in the service for another year after that.
Yes.
About right. What did you... you stay in that same group?
Yes. And came reasonably close to spending another year or two there as a civilian. They made a very attractive offer, which I found tempting. Even the service tried a little seduction. They said I played softball in those days, and I was a halfway decent softball player. And in retrospect, it's really very, very funny, but my unit commander or somebody like that came to me and said, you know, if you'd be willing to stay on to the end of the softball season, life would be pretty good around here. I thanked him very much. Told him I thought maybe I'd better get on with it. So it was a funny little exchange, but I guess it would have convenienced them if they hadn't lost all their troops quite as fast as they were leaving. And but I thanked them profusely and moved on.
You went to Illinois then. How did you select Illinois?
Oh, that was easy. Every staff at Miami were very positive on Illinois, and my brother Wendy, even though he was an Ohio State graduate, said that if you like organic chemistry, that's the place to go. And I don't think there was much doubt about that after the war.
Your interest in organic development as an undergraduate, is that correct?
Yes.
Yeah. What was it about organic that you said you loved the math, but that physical didn't have the...
Yeah. Well, I think my perception probably gained through my older brother was that that's where it was. You know, that's the basis of all the polymer work that DuPont was doing, and it didn't take a genius to figure out that organic chemistry was the chemistry of life. And the more we learn about it, the more we're going to be able to regulate those functions that are so important to us. You could see it happening. We were learning so fast, and you knew it was going to be exponential. And so it looked like a field that would just plain be fun. And you could see it at the graduate school level merging with biochemistry and all the other branches that dealt more directly with life science. And you just knew eventually that we'd understand what was going on at the molecular level, and you and I have lived to see that. Which is pretty darn impressive and fascinating. So it was easy to fall in love with that.
Did you, you went there in 46, got your master's in 47, your PhD in 49. Roger Adams, Carl Marvel, of course, are two names that come to mind right away. Did you interact with them in any
sense? Quite a bit. Well, with the whole staff. Harold Snyder was my research professor, and he's a wonderful man, and again, a great developer of people and other parts of the personality and the whole being than just science. Toussaint was great. They were all just wonderful people, and not just in the organic section, but in the physical and inorganic section. I just thought that staff was unique in the quality of the people and in the way in which they interacted. They were really very, very close, very supportive of one another, and very helpful to young people that were trying to find their way through.
How did you select Snyder as your mentor?
I liked his mannerisms, his approach to teaching, and his approach to his students very, very much. Any of them would have been fine, but I don't know, just a little body chemistry, I guess. I just sort of liked his approach to life and the way he encouraged young people. So, frankly, it's been so long I can't remember whether there were any other reasons, but the kind of work that he was doing was I don't remember that being a tremendous plus or minus. He was just good at what he did, and he was working in a general way with different kinds of organic chemistry, and I thought I'd be a good fit, and it was a fine relationship.
Did he have a big group?
Pretty large. There were, as I recall, give or take a dozen. That may not be the right number, but he had had seminars in his home for all his research students several times a year, so that the third-year people and the ones that were just coming into the group all met together, and we'd each talk about our research. But in those sessions, in his home, in a very friendly environment, we talk about a lot of things. You know, talk about life much more broadly than just chemistry. So he was a very positive and a very strong influence on a lot of his people. And as a result, they stayed very close to him throughout his life.
Yes, you did. At least you had one paper in JAX with Snyder on sulfanilamides. That was your thesis work?
That was one. I worked on sulfanilamide analogs of fatty acids, unsaturated acids. Chemistry was simple, but most fatty acids don't behave very well in a pot. So it was difficult work. But, perhaps nothing very profound, but all good fun.
During this time, were you in contact with your brother at all? Did you maintain any contact? Mm-hmm. Or
we always have been good friends, and so there were some communication, but not a lot. Grad students don't write lots of letters. At least I didn't.
Because he was at DuPont, was it preordained you were going to come here, or had you thought of other possibilities?
My view was that my brother Don was here too. And my brother-in-law had worked for Remington for a while, so it looked a little incestuous to me. And my initial thinking was that two Heckerts and DuPont was enough. I was glad to go and see them, but I really thought I ought to go someplace else.